And up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, it's the Bathrop Spears Broadside's 1st of July 2021 show, when our major focus is the federal lawsuit being lifted by the federal court in San Jose, which happened on the 29th. That's going to be the subject of commentary from myself, another homeless activist, Gloria Rovay, Keith McHenry, Alicia Cool. We'll also have some rather extensive reporting from Monterey County from activist Becky Johnson. And we may be able to squeeze in some of the Mike Rhodes update from Fresno. So it looks like a packed show. So let's begin.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with the actual wording of the court order that was issued 3 hours after the hearing, which you can also hear by going to the Huff website. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom at Huff Santa Cruz, H-U-F-F Santa Cruz, all one word, .org. And you then go to Latest and Lost Shows, and you'll find it listed along with the Latest and Lost Shows, depending on how much beyond the actual hearing time you tune in to find the archive. And it was nearly an hour long, not terribly exciting, kind of disappointing for me, and you'll hear more of that discussion shortly on this netcast. But here's the actual wording of the final court order, though the summary of it is, you're on your own, folks, in the gentle clutches of the Santa Cruz City Administration, which in the past has shown it has no problems evicting people from parks, keeping them out even if it's a question of survival, a question of serious illnesses that are happening all over the place. They didn't mind evicting people in the dead of winter and giving them no place to go in addition to that, so sending them streaming out into the community. The fact that COVID supposedly has ended as a crisis or has abated for the time being was the hook on which the action was hung by the court, Judge Susan Van Coolen, making the ruling. Anyway, here's what she wrote. On December 30th, 2020, plaintiffs Santa Cruz Homeless Union, Santa Cruz Food Now Bombs, Alicia Avalos, that's Alicia Cool, Hannah Hegel, Chris Ingersoll, and Randolph Tolley, collectively the plaintiffs, filed an ex parte application for emergency temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction against defendant Santa Cruz City Manager Martin Bernal, Director of Parks and Recreation Tony Elliott, Chief of Police for the City of Santa Cruz Andrew Mills, and the City of Santa Cruz City, collectively defendants. The court granted the plaintiff's temporary restraining order application on December 30, 2020. After holding a preliminary hearing on January 6th, the court granted the motion for a preliminary injunction on January 20th, 2021. On April 1st, 2021, the court modified the preliminary injunction, permitting the city to relocate the campers to the benchlands. Since the court granted the motion for a preliminary injunction, the court has held several status conferences. After the last status conference, the court ordered the parties to meet and confer regarding issues raised at the hearing and set this matter for an order to show cause as to why the preliminary injunction should not be dissolved. two comments here by me. One, those ordered hearings did not really happen. Only one did, according to the Santa Cruz Homeless Union's pleadings and the claims of Anthony Prince, which I tend to believe. Instead, there was essentially an unwillingness of the city to meet physically to talk about the issues as ordered by the judge. That's number one. And number two, the court's wording several months ago said that this date, June 29th, was set as a date to decide why the injunction shouldn't be dissolved. That is, she was already thinking it's going to go unless the plaintiffs, Santa Cruz Homeless Union and the people it represents, could show some real concerns as to why it shouldn't, because, after all, they had already agreed that the city was doing a good job of taking care of homeless people in the crisis. That, of course, that kind of fatal admission by, I think, the Anthony Prince, Santa Cruz Homeless Union side, sure didn't help the case, but I think it ultimately sealed its fate in the direction of it. Well, what ultimately sealed its fate, I think, is a conservative and, I should say, reactionary judiciary that's class-based and doesn't pay much attention to what's going on. But the failure to challenge the city's bad faith, which I talk about this at greater length in terms of the past false claims the city has made about the shelter it's going to be providing or it has provided or the alternatives it's providing as it sweeps away campgrounds for its own reasons, some good, some bad, is pretty clear. And it's something the court was not really either aware of or at least was not made, I think, aware enough of. I'll read the rest of the order. On June 29, 2021, the court held the order to show cause hearing, and that was several days ago, of course, on Tuesday. For the reasons discussed at the hearing and as summarized below, the court now dissolves the preliminary injunction issued on January 20, 2021. When the court granted the preliminary injunction, the court noted that the keystone of the preliminary injunction is the current dire state of the COVID-19 pandemic. Additionally, the court explained that the vaccines rollout in the pandemic as it eases, dispersal of homeless persons from the encampment may no longer put them at greater risk for COVID-19, and reevaluation of the injunction will be necessary. As the parties acknowledge, the COVID-19 crisis, including in the city and county of Santa Cruz, has improved dramatically. Defendants have presented evidence, that's the city authorities that want to shut the park down, that there are only 53 active cases in the county, negligible COVID-19 hospitalizations, and an effective reproduction number that is currently reported as approximately 0.5. Additionally, the defendants state, the city states, that as of June 21st, approximately 70% of the total population in the 95060 zip code, where Benchlands is located, have received at least one vaccine dose, and 60% of the total population is fully vaccinated. Of particular significance to the court, defendants present strong evidence of the accessibility of the COVID-19 vaccine to the residents of the Benchlands. Every person who occupied one of the original designated spots in the encampment was offered the vaccine. The camp stewards, two city employees who are at the encampment 20 to 30 hours per week, continue to raise the availability of vaccine with the residents. Any resident who expresses an interest in receiving a vaccine is encouraged to engage with the health services provider who visits the site weekly to administer vaccines or to access a local clinic. The vaccines are provided at no cost to the recipients. However, evidence from both plaintiffs and defendants demonstrates that the number of residents in the Benchlands who are willing to be vaccinated remains low. At the hearing, plaintiffs argued that the city had assumed a duty to educate or persuade residents of the encampment to get the COVID-19 vaccine. As discussed above, the defendants have made a strong showing that the COVID-19 vaccines have been routinely offered and made readily available. The city also presented evidence that at least some information has been provided as well. to offer residents information about COVID-19 vaccines, as well as opportunities to be vaccinated. Plaintiffs offer only argument, as distinguished from evidence, to the contrary. The court finds that the city's efforts to inform the residents of the availability of the vaccine, not only at the site but at other nearby locations in the city, has, along with the broad general downward trend of COVID-19 among vaccinated populations, significantly ameliorated the state-created danger that is the underpinning of the preliminary injunction. Plaintiffs also urge deference to the recently updated Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidelines regarding infection prevention strategies for persons experiencing homelessness. To be sure, the CDC continues to provide helpful guidance regarding not only COVID-19, but long-term strategies for the population. However, the CDC guidelines, which do not address the guidelines' impact on the larger community, wherein unsheltered persons are located, are but one factor in evaluating whether the preliminary injunction should remain in place. And those guidelines, of course, talk about sheltering in place and not moving people around from place to place. That's my addition. Moreover, the guidelines' long-term strategies are beyond the scope of the complaint and the preliminary injunction in front of this court. I wouldn't say that would be the case, but she apparently does, the judge. Finally, plaintiffs argue that the advent of the Delta variant of a COVID-19 virus and its well-documented high rate of transmissibility mitigate against dissolution of the injunction. While the court recognizes the concern that this variant presents, as does any form of COVID-19, the city's demonstrated efforts to ensure the accessibility of the vaccine to the residents in the benchlands again obviates any state-created danger. With the general receding of the COVID-19 crisis and the availability of COVID-19 vaccines among the homeless population of the benchlands, the court finds that there is no longer a state-created danger that the court previously found arising out of the city's eviction order during what appeared to be the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. Further, plaintiffs acknowledge and the city affirms that there are no immediate plans to evict residents from the benchlands. Taking all of these factors together, there is no threat of imminent, irreparable harm, and the balance of hardships now tips in favor of the defendants. Accordingly, the court dissolves the preliminary injunction, effective as of midnight on June 30th, 2021. Parties have 14 days from the date of this order to file a stipulation or motion regarding dismissal. And, of course, a nice stipulation would be that there's no movement on the benchlands until there truly is adequate housing or campground facilities at least equal to that of the benchland in terms of sanitation and accessibility and availability, that before they move anyone out of there to somewhere else, or generally, as they usually do, or have around Highway 1 and Highway 9 recently, and along the Hell's Trail, as it's called, further up Highway 1, under the overpasses, no places whatsoever, is what they provided at that time. So that's the what the court has to say. Let's you want to examine further what kind of declarations were put into the court record, you can. I've put some of that online. I'll be putting more online if you go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, and I usually also reference it through the Huff Santa Cruz website if you want to follow any of it. It's all, in a certain sense, it's yesterday's news. In another sense, it's not, because now there's a bigger issue, a kind of, I don't know how much of a community we have in actuality in the benchlands in terms of its cohesiveness, but there certainly is a community of sorts down there, the largest collection of homeless people. I would say larger than and of longer and more stable duration than the Ross Camp of several years ago. There may have been other sort of hidden in the bushes encampments that rival it for longevity, but certainly not for numbers, the Benchlands area. So there may be a kind of potential solidarity there, and that's going to be and has been the subject of discussions and meetings that are going on. If you're interested, such a meeting will be happening probably is happening, well, is happening tomorrow in the Benchlands at 5 o'clock. That's right outside the courthouse, between the courthouse and the Benchlands, at the tables and chairs there. Huff will also be holding its meeting next week in the Benchlands, as it has for the last 3 weeks, at those tables and chairs at 11 a.m. on Thursday, and at 6 p.m. on Thursday today, as you're listening to this netcast, if you're listening to it on the day that it's actually intended to be sent out to the community, that's going to be happening at 6 o'clock on July 1st as well. I think they're meeting at mid-camp, though. They're not going to be meeting at those benches. If you want to go down to that, you know, zip down from your computer or wherever you're listening to this and check it out. And for me, the real issue is whether the people in the Benchlands can get together an effective strategy with supporters in the community for resisting what I think is the inevitable abusive whack-a-mole activity of the city, which is their go-to strategy for dealing with homeless encampments, which may not come tomorrow, may not come next week, but is inevitable. It has nothing to do with housing opportunities, health, mental health opportunities, drug prevention, or anything of the sort. It has everything to do with getting them out of sight and out of mind and out of town, and doing so as quickly and as expeditiously as possible with whatever fluff and frolic you need to cover up what you're doing. But let's take our first musical break. Here's a song by David Rovick's Houseless Radicals Collective.
Because the scions don't give a shit about people getting shot in their tents. Because clearly from where they sit, we might as well die on the pavement. Because they've been saying forever they'll stop this downward roll. Because those with their hands on the levers just watch the rising death toll. Because this system's been a Ponzi scheme since when the pioneers declared they found the American dream after the Trail of Tears. Because they say they own this butte where our ancestors worked and died, blowing gravel down the chute along this mountainside. So folks came together in solidarity, the Houseless Radicals Collective, PDXHRC. Because the rich have no way ahead except more of the same. Because we don't want to end up dead. Because this is not a game. Because the whole capitalist system, with all these lives at stake, just keeps creating the problems, for fuck's sake. So folks came together in solidarity, the Houseless Radicals Collective, PDXHRC. Because they think they own the earth, and we don't have a right. Like if you weren't rich enough from birth, you should just stay out of sight. In the basements of the churches, in the prisons and tent camps. Because they sit on their lofty perches while we sleep by the off-ramps. So folks came together in solidarity, the Houseless Radicals Collective, PDXHRC. So folks came together in solidarity, the Houseless Radicals Collective, PDXHRC. Which side are you on? 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 Which side are you on?
And if you want more information about the Houseless Radicals Collective, there is a website which is at HTTPS, well, it's PDXHRC.org. That's PDXHRC.org. And there, it appears by the website, indeed an activist group in Portland, Oregon. Some of their most recent posts, March 28th, 29th, that's a couple months ago. There's a sweep of the camp on Oak and Cesar Chavez at Laurelhurst Park. I used to live across from Laurelhurst Park in the old days. For Tuesday the 30th, they can show up anytime they want that day. We will be staying the night or until it is safe to leave. Please come to support your houseless sisters and brothers and defend them from state violence. And then on the 30th, they did not manage to successfully sweep the camp. They didn't even try because they knew people were waiting. This will be ongoing as they will show up as soon as they know we're gone. Bodies are still needed to occupy in shifts going forward. Hit us or stop the sweeps PDX up for just information or just show up. Bring camping gear if you're staying overnight and be prepared for possible confrontation with the police. If you're not able to confront police, then you can help by spreading the word or documenting it if something happens. Thanks. Update April 2nd. This action is still ongoing. We can use your support. Martini Block will open the Martini Bar at 6 p.m. located at our tent for mutual aid. Come down and enjoy a dirty martini. I've never heard of a martini camp at a homeless, at least an updated, honest, and above board. I don't know what I'd say to that. I'm not much of a drinker, but some folks outside are. Update April 3rd. The Laurelhurst defense is still ongoing. Some comrades from L.A. showed up to camp with us for a while. Update April 4th. It's been quiet all weekend, but that may change starting tomorrow. The city is not going to allow us to resist forever. The more bodies here when they decide to sweep, the better. Showing numbers shows not just the city, but everyone else in the community. There's a lot of folks who will not stand for the mistreatment of anyone, especially our more vulnerable populations. Update April 13th. We spend 2 weeks camp with our friends at Laurelhurst Park. I use the word friends in the most genuine sense. There are some great human beings who deserve better from the neighbors and city. They are safe now from the city as the council agreed not to sweep without posting another 72-hour notice. Because of that, in some instance with Chuds, we decided we would be safer if everyone left for a while. We're back at Fallout Camp doing some work, but if needed, we will head back. And then there's a notice of an autonomous demonstration at Brooklyn Park to stop the sweeps. No streamers, no megaphones, no peace police. This is an attempt to avoid having it co-opted by dogmatic nonviolence, stay on the sidewalk, be very nice, make your little protest, and then go home type folks. And they had a panel on April 10th. A movement of the evicted town hall and movement remnant. Again, this is all in Portland, and it's all a couple months old, but it may give us some inspiration here. And actually, it's far more useful to be talking about this than to be talking about this court decision, which I'm going to be spending an inordinate amount of time, probably, because that's kind of what I've charted out for today's show. So I'm going to apologize in advance, but I'm under time pressure. Maybe on Sunday I can get to more nitty-gritty actions of resistance. So there'll be some discussion of that as well. And again, if you want to help engage in resistance, I would show up at the camp meetings that the Union of the Homeless is showing. That's going to be on July 2nd at 5 o'clock, as I said, as I was saying before, at the tables right outside the courthouse, between the courthouse and the benchlands. As well as other events are being planned by Food Not Bombs and the Union of the Homeless. And Huff may stick its nose in as well. We meet there every week, as I mentioned before, and get updates, reports, and who knows, we may actually, you never can tell what Huff will do, and which usually isn't much. But even a little jabbering is better than silence on occasion. So let's begin with some commentary by Keith McHenry on the situation in the benchlands in the wake of the dissolution of the injunction. Talking with Keith McHenry, it's June 29th. They just finished listening to a Zoomed hearing with Susan Van Coolen, federal judge, Anthony Condotti and Anthony Prince, attorneys, Union of the Homeless versus City of Santa Cruz attempt to dissolve the injunction. What are your thoughts, Keith?
Yeah, take a chair. Yeah, well, if they're available, if you can see them, take them. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, you're in the benchlands, and you've been actually playing the whole thing for a crowd. How many people are listening to it?
Well, we have like maybe five people listening.
Uh-huh.
We're at the county building because they never set up the picnic tables and canopy, so they're still not set up. It's funny. Underneath the footbridge, they normally do it. But anyway, so that was cool. People did that. And
What was your reaction? What do you think were the strongest points made by both sides?
Oh, I don't. Neither side has any strong.
Yeah, I tended to agree with you there.
Yeah, I think it was like I think it was kind of too much energy on you know, it was probably a mistake to talk about education of vaccines. And I think Vancouver actually was accurate that a lot of people just don't want it, or they do, and it's not like they don't have information, even if they don't have access to TV. And I don't think that when I read the fact sheet, it's like, well, okay, I'm not getting that. So it seemed like to me. So I don't know. It's just like people, you know, it's the way it is.
Well, I know one of the things
that was not very strong. In fact, one of the people sitting with us had gotten the vaccine right there. He wasn't looking too good from it, but he did get it. But it could be that he wasn't looking too good before the vaccine, so that was, neither here nor there. But he showed us his card and everything, so that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And,
anyway,
so I think that was not an important point, you know. I think it's...
I know I asked you to ask him, or, to press him, to include the city's bad faith in the past regarding Benchland's evacuations, that you can't rely on the city not to move in and within 3 or 4 days, as you could have seen in December.
Yeah, well, both me and Alicia mentioned repeatedly, and in fact, it's kind of funny because most of what he talked about was not really the subject of our conversations in advance in preparation for it. And Alicia particularly was very strong about the idea that, you know, the last time they were in federal court and they said they weren't going to do X, Y, Z, that, you know, they're going to give everybody a housing or whatever. So but I think that they are on move. And so we pressed that point to him a couple of times. I think the problem for him was that he knew that there was no victory ultimately in the actual, you know, COVID things and stuff like that. And therefore, the best we could get, which would actually be a huge win, would be his proposal, which is that, that there be like a court-monitored relationship between the union, food not bombs, the people living in the park, and the city, and that there would be sort of like a judge overseeing it. That actually would be... in this particular situation, could have potentially been really valuable.
I don't understand how that would have been valuable without a assurance that there'd be no movement from the benchlands without alternate shelter. That would be the issue.
That would be what the committee would be working on.
Well, that would be the but that would mean maintaining the injunction. That's what that would mean.
Well, we were looking for a modification of the injunction that was just the idea of this joint effort and cooperation, and if that had happened, then when they come time to move everybody, it would have to go before the judge. Whereas if there was no such interaction, but it would have to be a modified injunction. It wouldn't be. It would not be that the entire injunction is vacated.
I mean, that's what the hearing was about, which is vacating the injunction, and that's what the judge said at the previous hearing what they were going to do. That's what they announced it was about at the beginning of the hearing. So in order to stop that from happening, you had to make a real showing. And I think some of that started to happen towards the end of the hearing, because I think, you know, she did, although not very strongly, Van Kool and the judge picked up on Prince's pointing out that there was not really good faith by the city in these meetings. If there wasn't, I've got no idea. You're more likely to know more about that than I. But
everything we requested and talked about did not ever happen. Right, so none of that happened, and we were not belligerent. So anyway, nothing happened. And then this idea that...
How many meetings did you actually have with the city between the end of...
We only had one. They stalled and stalled until it was only time for one.
You know, as I said, I think he made the strongest points he made were that there had to be, that meetings would be helpful... to do this. And I agree with you that that would be something of a win if the injunction were kept in place. But it sounds like you're not very optimistic about that.
Yeah, I don't think so. Unless, you know, what an injunction in place would be at this point would just be a modified injunction that would essentially be nothing but this order for us to cooperate and meet together on some regular basis. So it wouldn't technically be a block to eviction from the camp.
Did he even propose that? I mean, I'm not aware that he did. That he did.
That was his proposal. Yeah.
He
seemed like he made a he mentioned that if there was an actual order, he forgot to give her in advance.
I mean, not only did he forget to, if that's the case, he also forgot to mention that before this camp is dissolved, there will be a return to the court to be sure that there's alternate shelter or that the conditions have been met. He didn't make that clear at all, if that's what he was looking for. At least I didn't hear that in this hearing.
Yeah, that was not very clear. Hopefully it's more.
This is the same problem I had with Prince before, which is when he abandoned the entire San Lorenzo Park to move everybody to the benchlands. Sounds like he was doing something similar, doing the Clintonian triangulate with the Republicans approach. Give them everything.
Well, I think the biggest, I mean, it's kind of this weird thing in that I think that making so much of a, you know, it was of a focus originally on COVID was probably way too much of a mistake in one sense, but in the other sense, it worked for 6 months. But in the long run, it wasn't, you know, that, you know.
But we won't really know until tomorrow, unless you have some inside knowledge.
Or the next day, you know, I don't know, it might be a day or two. And it's a kind of a frustrating thing, and it could have maybe been stronger about how dishonest the city was in the Ross Camp case.
Well, if he'd bothered to come to the community and other activists to actually talk about it in detail. I mean, he did get some information from Alicia and from you, and there are other people who have been around who could have given him more information, but he didn't. I mean, I guess you said he came and once met with the people in the park on one occasion?
In the last little bit he came by, yeah. Before that, he's been in the park a few times.
Mm-hmm. Hold formal meetings with people who've had experiences with the previous camps or service providers who have a history of this?
I mean, just the people that were like the plaintiffs and people, you know, friends of the plaintiffs, basically.
And was this done to get information from them that about what the strategy should be or to impose his views as to what the strategy should be, as I thought he generally does?
Everybody said, you know, the main thing is that people are, you know, have no place to go, and that they should stop being criminalized.
And that did not come up one fucking time in this hearing, I want to point out.
Yeah, because that's why I think it was somewhat of a mistake to have so much of a focus on.
You know, but even just to mention it once. You know, to mention he just started getting specific about Chico and he got specific about California, but there was nothing specific about the recent sweeps at Highway 1 and 7 and 9, about the Hell's Trail, about the upcoming Poganip sweep. All these are real things that are happening right now where the city is sweeping away stuff without shelter. It's obvious this would have had some kind of impact. I mean, he might have been told to shut up, but he could have mentioned it, but he didn't. And you guys didn't press him to do that in a way that...
Well, that's all we talked about at the meeting.
Yeah, but did you say let's take a look at the declarations and also we'd like to see your legal arguments?
Well, that's what we argued, that we wanted to have that be what was going on. That's what both Alicia and I were suggesting be important to focus on.
And did he agree to do that, or did he not agree to do that?
Well, I go, I see what you mean, but he didn't say he was going to do it. And I was so what his argument was. We didn't have hardly any conversation about that. So that was kind of unfortunate.
To say the least.
Between, you know, yesterday's meeting and today, but, you know, our focus was no place to go.
So you met with him yesterday?
Yeah, by phone, you know, at 4 o'clock, yeah. So that was...
yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, that's been... Alicia and my point all along is that there's no place for people to go, and that they lied last time. And she mentioned that this, you know, last yesterday, and I did too. And that's the real.
Have you and Alicia talked about getting a different attorney, like Gettleman or somebody local? Have you had? Because you know Gettleman took Nay's case, so and got was successful with it.
We're working on.
I don't want to hear the working on. Have you actually talked to these people specifically?
Yeah, we do talk to them, and we're waiting for. We're trying to convince them they don't need to wait for harm to happen from the.
You're talking about a citywide injunction.
Like, oh, well, okay, well, we want to challenge the new law, so we'll wait for there to be the first.
Who gives a shit about the new law? The real issue has to do with an injunction on moving people anywhere in Santa Cruz at all under any pretext unless they have places for people to go. I mean, you know, the new law is a diversion. It's one of the little things in Mill's checklist. And Well, then why are you talking about this being a... Why is this working on it? It's not working on it. It is working along a line that looks like you're doing something when you're not actually addressing the real solid issue. That's my perspective on this.
You know, I have to say that, too, once you get pushing a lot on this, the one common comment by Anthony, which is, you know, reasonable on one hand, but not necessarily good from, or, you know, litigation perspective, is that the most important thing is to build a strong union. And which I agree that that's really very important. But
depends. A strong union means people. If it means people buffing up Anthony's paid position as an organizer, which he has, to run around and say, look at all the good things I've done in all these communities, if that's what a strong union is, you got a different idea of a strong union than I do.
No, that's not what he does not like that. He doesn't want that to be considered. No, he wants us to have, like, regular meetings with the officers who make decisions of the group and organize actions and those kind of things.
And that would only mean something if you took positions that were strong, and when he did something different, you held him to account, which you have never, ever done, Keith. Ever.
Every time we have meetings, we...
In private, you urge, you suggest... But when a member of your union, I know two of them, who get fucked over, you know, you repeat the same thing again. Not you, although Alicia did, but not you.
Yeah, well, anyway,
I mean, you know, it's just an example, but what, you know, what can we do? Anyway, so there's a meeting tonight, right, at 7?
You know, that's the best thing to do. I'm, like, supposed to be doing something, I'm certain of it.
Think fast, Keith. Anything to get out of the conversation, huh? Man.
Well, no. I'm trying to set up the fucking stuff on you.
Well, I'll let you get to that. That's more important than this conversation.
Okay, so, take care. Bye-bye.
You take care, man.
Well, when this fertile valley was stolen, it was a process assisted by an epidemic that wiped off the earth most any who might have resisted. The land was parceled and given away to any brave pioneer who was white enough to own property around here. When this fertile valley was stolen, it sealed so many a fate who'd no longer live by a trading post, but in a stratified settler state, with a white-landed gentry created by colonial decree. We're not talking about the Bible, but a few generations of history. When this fertile valley was stolen, it was easy to foresee that so many, many years later, there'd still be a white majority. It was engineered from the day the exclusion laws were made. Any pretense of inclusion since has been a sick charade. When this fertile valley was stolen, the pioneers were given their farms. which were defended from the displaced by force of arms. And by dint of reason as false as any that could be, enforced by laws and customs called white supremacy. When this fertile valley was stolen, a process was set forth to make another bastion of capitalism to the west and north of freshly conquered California, Arizona, and the rest of the disease and theft and slaughter when the pioneers went west. When this fertile valley was stolen.
And that's one of David Rovick's collection of Oregon songs. I think he's, I don't know if he's living in Portland right now, but he's done a lot of songs around Portland. So this is a bunch of them. This is one of a collection which I'll probably be playing more of. It was called When This Fertile Valley Was Stolen. I think he's talking about the Multnomah River Valley, where I actually was born up there too, but didn't live there much after age, gosh, what was it, 6 or 7, something like that. Anyway, let's get back to the Santa Cruz scene and the situation in the Benchlands, a very, very small valley, but it's where a number of people are living, at least for the moment, and see if we can guarantee their survival there, or at least guarantee they won't be forced to evict or evacuate without some legitimate place to go.
Just listened to the June 29th court hearing, which ended 10 minutes early. It was kind of interesting. And I was listening to it here with my fellow activist, Gloria Rovay. Gloria, what impression did you come away with from that hearing? I see you took a lot of notes.
Yeah. Well, I appreciated that the judge told Cassie Bronson to stop making faces.
Cassie Bronson is the assistant city attorney who was one of the three attorneys, probably four attorneys if you count the judge, Susan Van Coolen, who were on this Zoomed hearing. The other two were Anthony Prince defending the Santa Cruz Homeless Union, or I should say advancing their cause to continue their injunction against the city. The city was the defendant in this case, as mentioned before and earlier in the netcast. And then, of course, there was Tony Condotti, who is the official city attorney, on with this analysis.
In reaction to what, I guess, Prince was saying? I had noticed her making faces at the other hearings. I think that she's going to dissolve the injunction. She's not. Prince didn't give a very good argument. The city did even worse, but Prince didn't seem to have it together. He wasn't very well organized. Just my observation. He kept talking about getting assurances from the city. I wasn't quite sure what he was talking about.
Prince kept focusing on the need for a joint committee and the fact that the city had only had one meeting. And I guess the city claimed it was relying on, I guess, the actions of Jeremy Leonard and Chris
Monteith.
Is it Monteith, his last name? Who are having weekly meetings with people. And again, it's unfortunate, as I've told Jeremy myself when I've spoken to Jeremy, that one of the reasons he's mistrusted by Union of the Homeless is he is a representative of the city. He is not a representative of the campground, but he, I think he would like to be in some sense, although he doesn't live there. And of course, again, as was pointed out by Bronson, neither do any of the union members who would meet in the meetings with the city officials on those rare occasions when they met. Neither do they live in the campgrounds.
Though it is true that Randolph Tully, also known as Dreadeye, though he lives mostly in his vehicle, also spends a lot of time in the Benchlands as an active union member there and considers himself part of the Benchlands community.
As I was saying, kind of muttering under my breath as this was going on, I think one really primary weakness of the proposal, and this could be my bias, just I have a sort of a historical bias. I believe you've got to look at the history of what people have done to come to some conclusion as to what they're likely to do in the future, though, of course, it's not determinative, but it can be suggestive anyway. The history of the city in previous clearings of the Benchlands with very little notice and with no alternatives is really pretty, it's repeated, it's specific, and their assurances to the city council about available shelter being developed are also unreliable, is really the word. And that issue, as well as the lack of shelter in Santa Cruz generally, which I guess Prince told Keith McHenry apparently that he avoided because the judge cautioned him that they were not on, they were dealing with, or he felt the issue had to be really the COVID situation, the vaccination situation, the general threat. Still, I think that issue is an important one based to judge the credibility of the city's claims. And he didn't present that kind of evidence, which admittedly is not about an imminent current threat, and it's not about conditions that are current and immediate. I guess I'm reiterating but I think it's a factor, and he didn't want to get into that apparently, or he certainly didn't take the opportunity to respond to if Keith McHenry brought that up to him, as I repeatedly suggested to Keith, and I guess occasionally to Alicia, they bring it up to him and that he put it into the documents. It didn't show up in the documents except, I don't think it showed up in the documents, which I just received, at least some of them, perhaps all of them, finally, not from Anthony Prince, of course, who I had previously requested documents from and gotten bitter denunciations from, and even a statement that I was expelled from the union or suspended from the union. But got them from Condotti, the city attorney. And there's no evidence, indication that the question of the shelter shortage and the shelter emergency, as it's really called, which affects the well-being, and it can be an imminent threat, particularly in the middle of a COVID epidemic. It may not be one you want to talk about a lot, because you would prefer to, you know, play your stronger cards. But when the stronger cards are fading away, as the COVID epidemic is fading away, it appears, in the United States, or at least here for the moment, then you want to bring in the longer history and the present reality of complete lack of shelter and the city's recent actions in sweeping Highways 1 and Highway 9 and sweeping the so-called Hills Trail and planning to sweep the Poganip on July 1st. In closing shelters elsewhere in the city. It's all this is really, I think, important information, none of which was specified by Prince or acknowledged by, of course, by the city, which wouldn't want to get into that. And I think that given the likelihood that the injunction will be dissolved, although I'm a little less clear on that, less certain of that. I never was really certain of it, but I think that may be a little less probable based upon the weakness of the city's arguments. And also, I think, Judge, as you were saying, Gloria, didn't like the facial expressions of...
I think the facial expressions, I think she was in response to, you know, she just go, oh. You know, whatever. I couldn't see it, but, you know, she made faces, and the judge said, stop it right now.
And we're talking about the assistant city attorney. I don't think she may not be very well informed on this issue herself.
Who?
Bronson.
Bronson?
Catherine Bronson. So she may be actually seriously thinking that Anthony is providing a lot of bullshit and not non-factual claims or exaggerated claims.
They didn't have a good argument. The city didn't.
Well, the city didn't have a lot of information. They had some, but not much. And she may be unaware of the broader situation. She may be...
Bronson?
Yeah. She may not be particularly aware of the shelter shortage. Or she may be believing the claims that everything's okay. Or she may just simply buy the perspective, as she puts it, that the homeless will go wherever the damn well we tell them to go, and the city will spend its money the way it wants, and it's our fucking business, and get out of our town, saying this both to the courts and to the homeless. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of a, you know...
She's arrogant.
Sort of a small-town... parochial kind of approach where this is our city, go away, which, you know, it's a kind of a Take Back Santa Cruz sort of notion. And it really, of course, completely underrates, undercounts, undervalues all the homeless folks who are here, as well as the people likely to become homeless. I mean, I get skeptical of Keith McHenry's, oh, there's a rent crisis going to strike us on July 1st, et cetera. And the day, it's kind of a moving target. The rent crisis target always moves ahead for Keith. But for some, it's very real. And yet, at the same time, the city itself is... notorious. Its staff is notorious for another thing that wasn't mentioned, I think only mentioned very for momentarily, was this new camping ban ordinance. The failure to provide specific information about stuff they're opening up. I think it was mentioned in the papers, the filing documents, which I've posted online, at least a link to those documents that'll be available for another month, after which you have to contact Huff to find those documents, because I hope I've got them on some computer here. I'm actually more hopeful than I was at the end of the last meeting, because I really thought this would just be a slam bam goodbye Anthony Prince thing from this, and perhaps it was. Perhaps she's come. I got the initial arguments by Susan Van Coolen or presentation that she said she essentially this hearing is to dissolve the injunction. And what have you got to counter me? You know, because I heard the city's arguments, and there's no imminent threat, and people have been vaccinated who have chosen to be vaccinated. And you can't really force people to be vaccinated, so, you know, it's not going to change. It's not that much different. And I thought Anthony Prince's arguments, oh, well, there's not enough education down there, were kind of contrived and designed to focus on her interest in the COVID issue as being the main thing that has to be dealt with, when in fact, in the safety of the people there involves a lot of other issues, and the credibility of the city involves a lot of other issues. Any other thoughts?
I think that, well, I think from Keith's point of view, at least, the vaccination thing is not a main point in the camp thing. And he doesn't believe in the vaccinations. And, you know, at least that's the impression I've gotten. And most of the homeless people don't believe in the vaccination or even the COVID pandemic. But they're not getting sick.
Well, I think also the real issue is the likelihood of the campground to be broken up in the near future by the city, because that would indicate a kind of bad faith or at least a concern to Susan Van Coolen. And that, I think, is the strongest part of the arguments that happened at this hearing, that the campground would likely be broken up, and that the city did not give any reassurance that it wouldn't.
Right.
And Van Coolen may stick to a strictly legalistic analysis, which is, well, then come back and get another injunction when you get notice it's about to happen. Mm-hmm. And she
That's
did, and she also didn't turn to this. Sorry, what were you saying?
She in fact did say it's not imminent.
Yeah, she said that, but she also said that. She didn't say to the city, Will you let the campers know if there's going to be, are there any plans to break up this encampment, and how much notice will they get? What will their accommodations be if it's broken up? The fact that these questions were not asked by her is significant in indicating this. She may feel this is outside the purview of the injunction, although she may consider them if somebody wants to come back with a second injunction. One wonders if Prince or anybody else would take on a second injunction when we can't even get the an injunction, the broader citywide injunction, which might have saved the lives, the property, the living space of hundreds of people who have been displaced and hundreds more who will be displaced in 2 days or starting in 2 days in the Poganip. Actually, it's already going on, I think. I'm not sure what their timetable is. I haven't heard about any notice that they've gotten.
I am concerned, though, that if people are just sent out, away, there are so many visible homeless now. People have to be wondering where they're going to go.
They will go out of sight, or they will be given citations or threatened by police, is the approach that is likely to be used by the city council. And by the police, empowered by the city council's new law. That's my suspicion. Though the law itself doesn't actually go into effect until July 24th or something.
Oh, really?
Be July. Well, let's see. No. I think the law was passed on the 8th, so it'll be July 8th when the law actually goes into effect. Although there are provisions that say there'll be limitations until, there's shelter and there's storage and so forth.
And I've been getting a little muddled in my dates. I believe it is a month from when it was passed at the June 8th City Council meeting for a second reading. The new and actually just sort of heightened and tightened and intensified lynch law camping ordinance. I call it a lynch law because it really denies some so fundamental basic human rights. And it's, although it doesn't use nasty wording, it uses a lot of friendly wording and we're all doing this because we really want this best interest of the community, best interest of the homeless. It's a fluff city in that regard. Anyway, it's the date when theoretically it actually becomes law in the books is the 8th, I believe it's a month after the 8th of July then. I think I said July 4th at other times. I don't know why I sometimes screw my dates around, but don't believe everything I say is my suggestion. Check it out for yourself. Anyway, let's hear a little music from David Rovix.
Black Lives Matter going on, and I figure that I could at least help in the effort by telling people a little bit of history about some of the places that they live in. Like, why would people be upset? And one of the things that people often observe when they go to the West Coast, if you travel from, like, Southern California up to the Northern Washington, you will notice that especially before you cross the Oregon border, and for the entire time you're in Oregon, up until you get quite a ways into the state of Washington, you are very unlikely to see many people who are not white. There's a reason for that, which is that for most of the history of the state of Oregon, people of color were not allowed to own property or work most jobs. And there were signs up, sort of the opposite of welcome signs up, outside of all the towns that said, basically, leave by dusk if you're not white, or you'll be lynched. That was called the Sunset Laws. So as you can imagine, I wrote another cheery song. You want to understand what happens today? You got to know how things got this way, so let's back up from the present date and examine the history of a state. As with the rest of the stolen land, mass murder is how it began. From the first days of the territory, only white men could own property, and to them the land was given for free, from Waloa to the Pacific Sea, taken by force, then handed out, leaving no room for the slightest doubt that a white homeland was the intent. And to make it certain just what was meant, signs were posted that clearly read, "Leave by dusk or end up dead. Best get out of town before the sun goes down. 'Cause if you're not white, that's probable cause here in the land of the sunset laws." The Oregon Territory's constitution explained the methods of exclusion. It wasn't subtle, it was all too clear. Non-white people not welcome here. And when Oregon joined the USA, it entered the Union of Laws this way. Salem could fine and lash and kill to enforce the white man's will. Best get out of town before the sun goes down. 'Cause if you're not white, that's probable cause here in the land of the sunset laws. After the War of Gray and Blue, exclusion laws were passed anew. They weren't repealed for 60 more years after the Klansman rule of Walter Pierce. It feels a lot like nothing's changed. Looks a lot like a firing range. Who owns the land? Who keeps the order from Portland to the California border? Best get out of town before the sun goes down. 'Cause if you're not white, that's probable cause here in the land of the sunset laws.
And if you're interested in more info on sundown towns, there's a book by James W. Loewen on that subject. I think I talked about it, probably did talk about it about a decade ago, around the time it came out. There's a brief blurb online, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism by James W. Loewen. From Maine to California, thousands of communities kept out African Americans, or sometimes Chinese Americans, Jewish Americans, etc., by force, law, or custom. These communities are sometimes called sundown towns because some of them posted signs at their city limits reading typically, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you," in whatever the town was. Some towns are still all white on purpose. Their chilling stories have been joined more recently by the many elite and not-so-elite suburbs like Grosse Pointe, Montana, or Edina, Montana. I guess it's Grosse Pointe, Michigan, that have excluded non-whites by kinder, gentler means. And Loewen writes, "When I began this research, I expected to find about 10 sundown towns in Illinois, my home state, and perhaps 50 across the country. Instead, I found about 507 in Illinois and thousands across the United States." This is their story. It is the first book ever written on the topic. That's Sundown Towns by James W. Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N, if you're interested. So we're very shortly going to get Alicia Kuhl, president of the Homeless Union. She will be giving her analysis under my questioning. But first, I'm going to hearken back to a story that I read about. I think it was either from the Mercury News or the Sentinel. Maybe one came from the other. I think they quoted a Sentinel reporter about a guy who was harassed at the boardwalk by security guards because of tattoos he had on his arms. And I'm going to play a little bit of that now.
A San Jose dad who visited the Santa Cruz boardwalk with his son in tow claims he was kicked out because a security guard thought his tattoos appeared gang-related. Turns out the guard was wrong. KPIX5's Marie Medina with how the park staff is responding to the allegations tonight.
A spokesperson for the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk says they are reviewing their policies after what happened on Sunday to a dad who simply wanted to spend Father's Day with his son here.
For Pinoy pride on my arm, this gentleman right here was telling me to get out of the park basically because I have tattoos.
A Father's Day that will be unforgettable for Mark DeVera.
You're stating to me that I can't be in this park having a tattoo on my back?
But not in a good way.
Excuse me, sir. But you're not allowed in the premises. Basically, that's what he said.
Mark claims he was recording his son on a ride when a security guard tapped him on the shoulder and told him to leave because of his arm tattoos.
He goes, "Well, it's against our policy that, you know, it's gang related. I said gang related.
Mark shared,
proud of my country. You know, I'm proud of who I am.
Mark says he asked to speak to a manager who told him he could stay as long as he wore a shirt to cover his ink.
I was just like shocked.
Well, you just have to cover it up.
Cover it up?
Are you seriously? There's like hella people here who has like different tattoos.
And I pointed at them and I said, you're not going to talk to that guy and tell him to leave because he's representing Las Vegas? And all I heard was crickets. Like, they couldn't even respond. And I was like, wow.
He claims to make matters worse, he was followed and watched by security. Mark, who raises awareness about recent anti-Asian hate, says he's proud to be Filipino and he should be able to express that.
I felt embarrassed. I'm being harassed here and violated. You know, I felt like I've been stripped off of my First Amendment. I'm a dad of four who works Monday to Friday.
And the Boardwalk spokesperson says they asked guests to cover up their tattoos or clothing if it could cause, quote, negative or aggressive reactions. They also deny Mark was ever kicked out, instead claiming he was asked to cover up his tattoos. They are, however, trying to determine if changes to their approach are warranted. In Santa Cruz, Maria Medina, KPIX 5.
There's a little bit of that story that's missing. Because there was a kind of a blurb in the tape. I'll read a bit from the transcription underneath or the story underneath that audio, or actually video broadcast. You can actually see pictures of the offending tattoos. "Excuse me, you're not allowed on the premises." Basically, that's what he said, said De Vera. He goes, "Well, it's against our policy. That is gang-related." I said, "Gang-related?" De Vera shared his tattoos on social media that show Pinoy on one arm and Pride on the other. Two words, he said, that have nothing to do with gangs and everything to do with his ethnicity and his country, the Philippines. "It's an expression of me being proud to be Pinoy, a Filipino gentleman." He said, "I'm proud of my country, you know, I'm proud of who I am." De Vera pulled out his cell phone to record the guards after he said he was tapped on the shoulder while he was recording his young son who was on a ride. He said he was confused at first and then angry when he realized the guards had mistaken his tattoo for being gang-affiliated. "For Pinoy Pride on my arm, this gentleman right here was telling me to get out of the park basically because I have tattoos," De Vera could be heard saying in cell phone video he shared with KPIX. "So you're stating I can't be in the park having a tattoo on my back?" De Vera asked to speak to a manager who he claims took a look at his tattoos and said they were fine. The manager, however, stated De Vera still had to cover up the ink with a shirt if he planned to stay at the park. "I was just like shocked," said De Vera. I said, "You're not going to talk to that guy and tell him to leave because he's representing Las Vegas?" And all I heard was crickets, and they couldn't even respond. I was like, wow. De Vera said there were multiple park guests with tattoos, including one man he recorded on his cell phone with tattoos on his arms, legs, and as well as neck. The man is seen wearing a Las Vegas tank top, and his leg tattoo reads LV. To make matters worse, De Vera said he was followed and watched by security. He said his son was upset and cried after he was confronted by park staff. De Vera said he raises awareness about recent anti-Asian hate, told KPIX he's proud to be Filipino and he should be able to express that. "I felt embarrassed," he said. I'm rereading some of the stuff that was said in the actual audio, but nonetheless. "I'm being harassed here and violated. I felt like I've been stripped of my First Amendment. I'm a dad of four who works Monday through Friday." A spokesperson for the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk released this statement to KPIX. "As an open gate, free admission amusement park, all guests and their unique forms of expression are welcome. Some tattoos and other forms of expression may cause negative or aggressive reactions from some guests. At times, we might ask guests to cover these types of tattoos or clothing. When contacting a guest, our goal is to have a respectful dialogue about our policies and our efforts to ensure everyone has a safe experience at the park. With regards to the specific incident, the gentleman was not kicked off the boardwalk. We did engage him in a dialogue and asked him to cover his tattoo out of an abundance of caution. After a lengthy discussion, he agreed and remained at the park. However, this incident has caused us to engage in an internal investigation and discussion regarding our approach to this type of issue. We are working to determine if changes to our approach are warranted." That's our friends at the Seaside Company's Beach Boardwalk. Now let's hear a discussion with Alicia Kuhl in response to both the July 29th dissolution of the injunction and ongoing events in Santa Cruz. On the line with activist Alicia Kuhl, mother, worker, probably exhausted. Who knows? How are you feeling, Alicia?
I'm all right.
So today is the 30th of June. This is the day after the decision by Judge Von Kulin, essentially dumping the homeless into the arms of the city. What are your thoughts about this?
According to the court, it makes no sense for the injunction to go on because the camp is not under direct threat of eviction right now. Uh-huh. So I guess what that means is, it doesn't change anything as far as CDC guidelines. It's still against the guidelines to break up an encampment. So I guess the trust in the city is based on the city's statements once again in court that they won't do that. Was the remarks from Tony Condotti, the city attorney, was that they don't have any intentions of breaking up a camp that they've just established. So I guess we're on a trust basis right now, hoping that they don't just dismantle the camp. I guess that's where we're at.
I'm just wondering.
The injunction couldn't go on forever under the current circumstances, so, there's that.
I didn't hear any specifics from them, or frankly, any challenges from Prince requesting those specifics about whether people will be allowed to be there for a week, a month, 3 months. Will they be providing some alternatives if they kick them out? And I guess I'm worried, Alicia, because I've seen, and so have you, what the city has done in the past in the Benchlands and to the Phoenix camp, to the Ross camp.
Well, I have the same concern. That's the reason why we had to do the injunction in the first place.
Right.
It's because the city was willing to violate CDC guidelines.
Well, we may not have CDC guidelines. I think they've shown that they're willing to violate Martin versus Boise guidelines, and they also are willing to be not entirely, dishonest about their, or wildly exaggerated about their shelter opportunities.
I think they even recently even admitted that they're willing to be sued. So, they think they're willing to do just about anything that goes unchallenged, and pretty much even if it does, go challenged. And end up in a lawsuit. The city's willing to take those chances right now. That's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm hearing from city council.
Do you have any sense that, I think the city assumed that Von Kulin, the judge, was going to disperse the injunction. She said that 2 months ago, and then she did it. And it didn't have much to do with shelter, the realities of lack of shelter, or the credibility of the city. And I know that I think I read your declaration, but I haven't got it immediately in my mind now. I think you raised issues, as did Keith, about the lack of shelter, stuff that Anthony didn't really push too much, unfortunately.
Because the judge has kind of made it clear that that's not really part of the lawsuit. She's not really, interested, in those particulars. And she kind of made it obvious in the beginning, several hearings ago, that housing essentially isn't a right. People don't have the right, to camp at San Lorenzo per se. But we are, in a pandemic, and with the guidelines being what they are at this time, how the court deems it is that the hardship weighed in the favor of the people at San Lorenzo. It doesn't look that way in the judge's eyes at this point.
But the point is, the credibility of the claim that the city will respect the situation in the campground, not so much because those poor homeless need housing, but rather because COVID continues to be an issue in the community.
Yeah, I don't know if we're talking about what the future holds or whether the city can be trusted, or why the credibility wasn't mentioned further. I'm not sure. I'm not the lawyer. But I have obviously very little trust in the city based on their actions. So, only time will tell what they're going to do now. I speculated and I told Anthony what I think they'll do. I speculate that they will not immediately tear down the camp or give eviction notices, but they will kind of slowly do it or, maybe wait a month. Try to do some phase out system, something to make it seem like they're not just evicting everybody out back into doorways and back into the Poganim. So that's what I think they'll do, but we'll see.
So yesterday we had a meeting in the Benchlands to discuss, a small meeting, what alternatives people might have in the bench lands to deal with an issue if and when it happens, as I think you and I both agree, it's likely to happen at some point. If not tomorrow, then sometime in, I would say, the relatively near future. I don't know, when the first time they want to hold a taco festival in the Benchlands, you know. I mean, whatever their economic motivation will be, or some incident that comes up that they use, that may be the basis for moving people on. The question is, what can people do to address that issue? We were talking about that, and it's not like one's revealing any secrets by saying it was the community response, I think, as well as your legal work back in December, that helped to stop that at that point. Are you thinking perhaps that if there is a sudden notice to disperse the benchlands?
I haven't decided what to do yet, Robert. I know what you're getting at, and I haven't made a plan yet. I'm in the works of that plan right now.
Do you have the energy to do this? Because I know you've got so many balls in the air, kiddo.
And even if I had a solid plan, I wouldn't tell you on your radio show so that you can announce it to everyone, because that only impedes my effort.
Uh-huh. Well, I think, I mean, I got no problem with whatever choice you make on that regard. And obviously, I think it's good to get community support for what you're doing. But I'm saying also,
definitely, when the time for that comes, I would definitely need help.
Uh-huh. And what I'm saying is, you seem to be you're under a lot of burdens because you have numerous things you have to do, a job, a family, and so forth. What I'm saying is, do you feel you have the capability, as you did in December, to actually get all this together in short time, within, for example, 3 days, which will be, you know, when they do an eviction notice, that's what they're likely to give people, is that's what they've done in Highway 1 and Highway 9.
Do you mean, could I do another emergency injunction and take it back to court? Yes, I could do that.
How long does it take to do such a thing?
Well, last time we did it in, I don't know, 24, less than 48 hours. I mean, I'm not sure. I'd have to go back. It was quick, though. We all really worked hard to get it done quickly.
Do you think that the effect of the people coming the day before that injunction was granted, or I should say the preliminary TRO was granted, further assisted you in getting that done?
Well, definitely bought us time so that they didn't just immediately, you know, dismantle the encampment. It gave us time to get the injunction. And, of course, the community efforts helped us get declarations together and, you know, definitely.
Did much of your energy come from that community arrival, or would you say it was in the works from the days before?
I don't know. My energy comes from wanting to do the right thing and being pissed off about all this crap.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you are. I'm just wondering what kind of impact the community's arrival on December 28th had. And we know that on the 17th there was a failed blockade, and then on the 28th people showed up in greater numbers.
I definitely appreciate the community's support, and I think everybody in the park did. I think that shows, and it also shows people on city council and the people that are making the decisions what the greater community wants to see happen and where their heart is. So I definitely think it's important. It's appreciated.
Do you have any sense about where that community support is now? Because I noticed it seems to be ebbing, and it worries me, and I'm wondering how you're feeling about it.
Well, I think right now the community is probably just trying to wrap their minds around, you know, what does this mean? And no matter what, the city lacks shelter capacity. The shelter capacity is drastically going down. I actually think that the city knew that, and that's why they passed this ordinance now, this new anti-homeless, anti-camping ordinance, because they knew they'd have no shelter capacity and the visibility of homelessness is just going to be that much greater. So the city knows that, and at the bottom line is, at some point, where is everyone there going to go?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the, the elephant in the room.
Of course. I mean, the other issue, of course, is that the Poganip evacuations that are supposed to be, I don't know whether they're starting on July 1st or, deadline is July 1st, but that was mentioned by Lee Butler at the last city council meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, and we're in extreme drought, extreme fire hazard. I mean, it's not the best idea for us to have people camping all over the Poganip either. It's better that we provide services and housing.
Mm-hmm. Which aren't being provided, of course.
Of course not.
Any other comments about how things went at the hearing and what you're looking for from the community in the next month?
I mean, we need to keep a close eye and continue to support the people that are at the bench lands and keep a close eye on the city's behavior. Their ordinance is going to directly violate Martin versus Boise, so there's that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm probably going to be looking at everything very closely, documenting cases of harm, taking all of that and, you know, having documentation to show what the city's doing that is breaking the law and the spirit and letter of Martin versus Boise, because you have to challenge it and you have to have the evidence. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it will continue.
Have you heard many instances of it's being violated in the last month?
Well, Martin versus Boise is direct criminalizing people, and they haven't passed that ordinance yet, but they are definitely breaking CDC guidelines. They've broken up multiple encampments, even while the San Lorenzo Park injunction has gone on. I mean, all you have to do is read the Sentinel, and they talk about how they broke up the encampment on the side of Highway 1, how they just did the one on Camp Paradise. So they continuously break CDC guidelines. I think they're probably a lot quieter about how they're violating Martin versus Boise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that remains to be seen in the future because they're passing that ordinance, which is openly unconstitutional.
I'm just wondering if anyone has come up to you and said, I want you to take my case because I feel I was unfairly expropriated from Highway 1 and Highway 9 or Camp Paradise or wherever, or just hassled for being in my spot, you know, in Laguna or, you know, in the wherever the hell I was.
No, not locally in that respect. I've got dozens of cities, though, and local presidents of homeless unions or wanting to newly establish a homeless union saying, like, can you help us do an injunction here? We have a lot of that going on.
Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting you want people to call you on these issues? And I'm not trying to give you more work because I don't want to do that. But I'm just wondering, is there a sort of an internal counting place where people can, you want to send people to give their accounts so that if and when you suddenly do have to move quickly, as you did in December, you will be able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, they can stay in touch with me. They can email me.
And do you want to give out that information here over the net?
Sure. My number is 831-431-7766. That's the local union number. You can also reach us on the Food Not Bombs number, but I don't have that handy right now. It's an 800 number.
Mm-hmm.
And my email is alicia1l@hotmail.com. alicia1l@hotmail.com.
Any indication from politicians, staff members, other community supporters that struck you as supportive or maybe that the community should know about not so supportive? I mean, I know in the past you've had a lot of problems with Take Back Santa Cruz-ish types. How's that going?
I mean, I don't know of any, like, direct, like, things that have been established as far as anti, you know, San Lorenzo Park encampments or anything like that. I don't know. In general, I know that there has been a recent effort from council member Sonia Brunner to revisit the RV ban.
I remember that, yeah.
So that's, you know, something that's newly going to be discussed.
I think there was a Melissa Freebarn-initiated, I could be wrong about this, I think she was involved with a river cleanup deal that was happening a couple of days ago, but you may not have heard.
I don't know.
Yeah.
She's one of those people that I've gotten dozens of reports from people that have seen her planting needles and then taking pictures of them and then claiming that she's picked up needles. So
Have you ever
had some suspicious posts that I actually have seen myself between her and I think it was like Paige Concannon or something like that, talking about where can they buy needles. So, you know, that's all very suspicious to me.
So you yourself have not actually seen that happening in person.
I haven't seen that, no.
Okay.
And you would know if I had.
Well,
that would have been a big thing for me.
Yeah.
Unacceptable behavior right there.
I know that Paige Concannon was, you know, pushing this alternate homeless union stuff at city council at one point, actually got speaking time there. Anything more happening on that front?
Yeah, that was about as far as we got before the cutoff, but that was a pretty good chunk of analysis. And I recorded a kind of lengthy series of concerns about my what might be regarded as internal problems in the Santa Cruz Homeless Union, but I regard them as problems that occur in any organization, whether it's Free Radio or Santa Cruz Indie Media or Huff, where you have problems with the membership being heard, and then people being punished for dissident views, and there being a sort of an ongoing process where a very few people take up the great majority of the dialogue and exercise the power, and it becomes a kind of a top-down situation. I'm going to be talking more about this in the future, and hopefully there'll be some corrections in this whole situation as people in these different organizations, that includes the union, that would include Huff, that would include any organization where this is happening, take control again of what can often become the levers of power or the spokespeople for the organization or the decision-making process. It's important that that happened at the local level in Santa Cruz City as well. So let's hear a little music from David Rovix.
'87, on hills barren and forlorn, only 12 years shy of when my grandpa was born. In northeastern Oregon, by way of Idaho, where the waters of the Snake River flow. Just upstream from a prison now, but way back then, the gold rush drew people to the hills again. After 30 years of statehood for Oregon, back when the West was one. People came with companies, they came with little bands to mine for gold in the Western lands. People came from East and West, from New York and Chicago. They came from overseas and from San Francisco to the home of the Nez Perce before they were hunted down to a place they called Hell's Canyon, far from any town. They traveled out to eastern Oregon, back when the West was one. Some folks came to work mines, others came to trade in mining gear or brothels or whatever work that paid. Some folks were just passing through, others came to stay, such as some of those in the canyon in the month of May. They planned their ambush, the gunshots rang, pioneers all the Bruce Evans gang, there in the lands of Oregon, back when the West was one. Miners died, shot in the back, bludgeoned in the head. In a very short order, they were all dead. The gang moved upriver, found more miners unaware, set up an ambush, did the same thing there. How many Chinese miners slaughtered, no one knows for sure, although the total is at least 34. Bodies floating down the river, in Oregon, back when the West was one. After all the killing, after some of them confessed, there was a trial, and the justice of the West taught everyone watching what the exclusion laws meant when a jury of their peers found the killers innocent. And in Enterprise today, you'll find an arch for the pioneers to the memory of a murderer who once lived here. Yeah, welcome to Oregon in 2021. Here, where the West was won. Here, where the West was won.
And that's When the West Was Won, one of the many Oregon songs in the 2020 Compendium of Songs by David Rovics. You can find it online, I think. Or it's on his SoundCloud, anyway. But I'll be playing more of these songs probably on Sunday, if and when I get back to you, which I'm likely to do, because I keep doing these shows. And there should be a Street Spirit newspaper coming out soon. It is the 1st of July, after all, and I should be getting it next week, perhaps also with Street Sheet, the Coalition on Homelessness of San Francisco's informative, if slimmer. I think it's they were doing it twice a month. Now they're doing it once a month. Maybe they're now returning to their old schedule of twice a month. And so that should be coming up. If you want more information as to how you can distribute these papers or read them, usually you can go directly to the web for thestreetspirit.org, and you can browse for Street Sheet, which is the Coalition on Homelessness of San Francisco's paper, which has a lot of not just news about San Francisco, but regional news. Used to print regular reports from that we sent them here from Santa Cruz, but that hasn't happened for a while. Still, it's important to know what's going on in other cities. So, for instance, here's a story on the front page of the Chronicle's second section, the Bay Area and Business section, on the June 30th, Wednesday edition, by Dustin, by Danielle Echevarria and Annie Weinstein. Sausalito relocates homeless people. Amid drumbeats and chants of "We shall not be moved," Sausalito police officers removed residents of a homeless encampment at Dunphy Park late Tuesday morning after months of mounting tensions. Officers arrived at the park around 6 a.m., according to Robbie Powelson, a part-time resident of the camp and president of the Marin Homeless Union. Daniel Eganek, 84, the first person to put up a tent at the park, sat on a chair in front of the parked police car and said he was there to defend freedom, his plan and his hope to save the camp and the community that called it home since December wilted, I should say was crushed, when confronted with a phalanx of police officers and an accompanying bulldozer. A few hours later, the camp was dismantled. The encampment, dubbed Camp Cormorant by its residents, was a community of around 35 people, including some young people. Some were former boaters who were living on vessels that were anchored illegally out in nearby Richardson Bay. After being ousted from the boats, they started camping at Dunphy Park out of protest. The city has spent more than 6 months trying to relocate the camp to the nearby Marinship Park, a field tucked away just beyond the U.S. Army Corps boatyard, where illegally anchored vessels that were seized got crushed. That's a whole story in and of itself, which you may have heard Robbie Powelson talk about in earlier netcasts on this station, about how it became a sort of a gentrified attempt to destroy the essentially low-income boat residences that are really all around the San Francisco Bay, given the huge increase in rents that's happened over the last few decades. And it's an attempt to sort of drive them all out and literally crush their homes, which has been happening not just in Sausalito and North Bay, but in other places as well. After the residents of the camp protested, a federal judge blocked the relocation plan, citing concerns around relocation during the pandemic. Camp Cormorant's residents said being near the boat crushing yard would be hazardous to their physical and mental health due to toxic air quality concerns. The city won approval to move the camp this month in part because an air sample test done in March did not support the camp's claims of toxicity in the air. On Friday, camp residents were notified that they would have to leave by Tuesday. On Monday evening, the residents of Camp Cormorant sent a letter to Sausalito city officials asking for a meeting on Tuesday evening where they could go over their demands and wishes for the park. It appears no such meeting was granted. Amid the controversy and confusion surrounding the move, the Sausalito Art Festival, which is held annually at Marin Ship Park, canceled the festival for a second year in a row. With the court fight over the encampment, organizers scrapped the event. The city, a number of nonprofits, and the Festival Foundation will again miss out on millions in funds generated by the event. Signs painted on pieces of plywood adorned the walls of the camp Tuesday with slogans like Love Will Win and Stand Against Violence. I guess there's no mention of an additional place it could be done while people could still be allowed to maintain their place in Dumphy Park and not force the closing of this by being forcibly moved to this new place, but that I guess that's implied in the story. Another said 72 hours to relocate after 6 months, an issue that seemed to be a sticking point for many camp residents. In a statement, Sausalito Mayor Jim Hoffman reiterated that the move would be done with care. Bulldozing with care. We are making every effort to move in a manner that is safe, compassionate, and respectful of individual and community needs, she wrote. By 7:30 a.m., more officers arrived at the scene along with the bulldozer. After a confrontation between Eganick and a police officer, that's the 84-year-old guy who set his chair in front of the bulldozer, Powelson stepped in. The 27-year-old was arrested on three charges: obstruction of justice, unlawful assembly, and camping. They just want him out of the way because he rallies people, Guy Kelly, another part-time resident of the camp who also owns a ship and helps build housing for the homeless, said as he watched Powelson get handcuffed. Jeff Chase, 50, another Camp Cormorant resident who was dressed head-to-toe in red with rain boots, carried a megaphone he used to read Bible verses to police officers at the scene. Chase established the three small gardens at the camp where they grow tomatoes, cilantro, mint, and sunflowers, among other herbs and vegetables. He said that it was unlawful for the police to move the encampment and emphasized that it was not voluntary. They said in the eviction order that they'd save our stuff, but on the other hand, they have a bulldozer. By 10 a.m., police were tossing the handmade signs into a giant dumpsters. At least 10 officers stationed themselves at the corners of the encampment as crews brought in fences. Residents of the camp began to shout at them, chanting, "Shame on you! Shame on Blue!" They called the officers bullies and asked to see warrants. "What are you going to tell your kids you did today? Bullied poor people?" one resident yelled. As officers closed in on the tents, some residents began to pick up their things and leave. By 11:30 a.m., officers had started entering the tents that remained. Residents resisted, sitting or lying on the floor. "Move peacefully or you will be arrested," one officer yelled, as residents shouted back, "Don't push me." Those who refused to move were bodily escorted out by police. That was a story by Daniel Echevarria and Annie Weinstein, San Francisco Chronicle staff writers, "Unsheltered Residents Resist Move." And that's about it for this edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, except for a final interview, which I'm going to be playing. And that will end the show today. Here's a final bit of music to precede the interview, and then the interview itself, which is activist Becky Johnson talking about the forced relocation or the forced eviction of RV and van dweller folks.
I came to this country, left Scotland far behind, evicted from the Highlands, told to go and find a new life in America, across the Atlantic Sea, where I joined the millions of other refugees who ended up at Ellis Island as the century began. The wretched of the earth from every foreign land. When I came to this country, broken and
bereft. I quickly saw I'd have been no worse off if I'd never left. Such awful deprivations as I'd never had to face. Born by Swedes and Russians, Africans, and every other race. Millions of people trying not to end up dead from cholera or black lung or being clubbed on the head. I came to this country to have something on my fork. It was obvious the first thing was to get out of New York. I learned to hop the freight trains, some other stiffs and I caught a westbound rattler to give Oregon a try. Signed up for the logging camps, became a timber beast. If I'd stayed there any longer, I'd have surely been deceased. When I came to this country, I worked the copper mines in Butte. I was a Gandy dancer in Spokane in a Gandy dancer suit. I heard the rebel girl speak one night in a railway yard. I joined the union right away and got my first red card. Became a hobo organizer for the one big union grand, preaching the wobbly gospel across the starving land. When I came to this country, I soon enough lost track of the number of times I felt a billy club upon my back, or how many times I saw the tents with freezing kids working in the mines instead of living on the skids. How many times I heard the horrid crying from below of those trapped there in the dungeons with nowhere left to go. When I came to this country, it was a hopeful time of desperation. The red flags flew all across the nation. But when the war began in Europe, we refused to die and kill. We refused to fight a boss's war and serve the boss's will. That's when they got the Legion to burn down our union halls all across the land where there used to be four walls. When I came to this country, I had no great expectations, but I didn't think I'd end up back here awaiting deportation. On a steamship on the Hudson, I watched the sunset fade, with 20,000 others swept up in the Palmer raids. Counting myself lucky that I'm still alive, remembering the moment that I first arrived. When I came to this country, when I came to this country, when I came to this country, when I came to this country.
And that was David Rovics, The Ballad of a Wobbly. That's it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside, except for this update from Monterey County, from Becky Johnson.